Hey guys, welcome back to Vertical Momentum. I'm your host, Richard Kaufman, also known as the Comeback Coach. They say don't ever meet your heroes. Well, that's bullshit. I just got the opportunity to meet one of my favorite people in the world. You might have seen him on TV, in the big screen. If you haven't watched Studio City, guys, you need to watch Studio City. Just saying. And he's also an author. He got a new book coming out. And I want to talk about, we'll talk about his first book, which a lot of people don't even really realize he wrote that book. So we'll talk about that. Sean, my brother, welcome to the show.
Richard, it is such a pleasure to be here with you. You know, it's crazy how life works, isn't it? We just met a couple days ago when I was doing another podcast and connected immediately. And here I am, and I couldn't be happier. So thank you for the opportunity.
I love it. And now we're also brothers in Christ, by the way. And I want to say thank you. That's the most important thing in my life. So we're going to be talking about recovery, talking about music, martial arts. We're going to be talking about everything. But first of all, you know, what is your definition of resiliency? Because growing up in the Cleveland area, growing up in the Jewish, as a Jewish kid, I'm guessing it wasn't all rainbows, sprinkles, and unicorns.
Yeah.
So talk to me about what your definition of resiliency is.
Well, my definition of resiliency comes from one of my martial arts teachers, who was Master Fumio Demura. We just lost Sensei Demura this past year. He was actually Pat Morita's stunt double, and he is a world-renowned martial artist, and I was so blessed to know him. And he used to say, get knocked down 7 times, get up 8. And that always resonated with me. You know, you mentioned I grew up in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, left Cleveland when I was 5. And, you know, it was kind of a sort of a, it had been a steel town years ago. It was kind of a hard scrabble place in some respects. And I was one of probably 3 or 4 Jewish kids that went to school. And, you know, I was like a chubby kid with a bad haircut and glasses, not exactly the trifecta for popularity. And I very quickly found myself the target of being bullied. And that had a significant effect on my life for a very long time. You know, later I got into karate, and that really helped me. It helped me come into my own to acquire a lot of the tools necessary to not be bullied anymore, to achieve some sense of, you know, self-confidence. It taught me humility. It helped my body grow and strengthen and all sorts of things. But, you know, working with people dealing with bullying is a passion of mine because I experienced it firsthand. It's just kind of ironic that I would go on later in life to play this iconic bully Mike Barnes when, in fact, I was the guy getting bullied.
Okay, so, you know, let's talk about, because eventually you grew into your body. But like, I know at one point I was 350 pounds and then I went down to 170, but in my mind, I was still always that 330-pound guy. So it was kind of like I went from chunky to hunky, but then in my mind, I was still that fat kid and I still had that mindset that I'm still not good enough. So what was that like when the metamorphosis occurred?
So the metamorphosis for me occurred when I was about 13 years old. I had my mom take me to Weight Watchers. I got contact lenses. I started getting taller. But the exact same thing that you said, Richard, I really looked in the mirror and continued to see that insecure, chubby kid for a long time. And in my book, Way of the Cobra, I talk a lot about the concept of the inner child. And I came up with something that allowed me to heal my view of my inner child. And I share that in the book. And, you know, people do one of two things. We all have this idea in our head of our inner child. And it's not an accurate representation of who we are. What it is kind of this toxic receptacle that we create based on all the perceived failures we've had, all the criticisms and insults and pains and bullying that we've endured as kids. And it sort of culminates in this distorted image of who we see ourselves at our very weakest and most vulnerable and insecure. And you know, if people are being honest, we all carry around this idea in our head of what our inner child looks like. And if you can heal that relationship, it is revelatory in your life. And, you know, people do two things. They either treat the image of their inner child as a pariah, something that they're completely embarrassed of. And so they direct a lot of anger and hatred to it because they know that's not who they are now, but they're chained to it. And so it's like they have to drag around this almost this embarrassing image of themselves that they carry inside. And the other way that people deal with their inner child is they deal with it as, in some ways, almost like a badge of honor. It's victimhood, and they resent themselves and are angry with themselves for not being able to defend that younger, helpless version of themselves. Well, of course you can't do that because you can't be in two places at the same time unless you have a time machine, right? You know, now as a fully functioned adult, you could deal with all of the issues that you couldn't deal with as that inner child, and it makes you angry that you couldn't do it. And so it causes a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. And I talk a lot in my book about recognizing and identifying that you have this toxic relationship with your inner child. And then how do you heal it? Well, you heal it by asking forgiveness. It's simple. It's like most things in life. The solution to most problems are simple, but they're not easy. And you have to do something very difficult. You have to ask forgiveness of your inner child. And you can do this by writing a letter. You can do it by literally, you know, gestalt therapy, which is, you know, taking a chair and sitting it down there with a picture of how you envision your inner child and talking to it and saying, you know, I'm sorry, please forgive me for not being there to take care of you. I mean, I know it sounds silly and woo-woo, but it really works. And then you have to do the hardest thing. You have to forgive yourself. You have to forgive yourself. And so instead, what happens, instead of, you know, dragging around this image of your inner child as this toxic, embarrassing source of shame, the more you do this and you ask forgiveness and you communicate with it, you're going to reach a point where it no longer represents that shame and embarrassment. And it actually is going to become a positive. It's going to become a source where you can draw creativity, where you can look back and have a deeper understanding of some of the things that went into your childhood that later manifested in your adult life, and it can help you fix those in your adult life. You know, obviously so many problems that human beings encounter come from a very, very early point in their childhood, and identifying them is really the first step to eradicating them.
Yep. Now, okay, so let me ask you a question, because I told all my friends, bro, Sean's coming on the show. They're like, all right, ask this question. So I wrote them all down. But
they probably didn't think you were talking about the inner child, right?
Yeah.
They're like, talk about the All Valley Tournament.
Well, but you know what it is, because we're all struggling with the same shit, whether you're the CEO or the janitor. Totally. We're all struggling.
You know, Richard, you know, I spoke to the kids at the Indio Juvenile Detention Facility the other day. And I really wanted to have an impact on these kids. You know, these kids, some of them are going to be matriculating back into society shortly, and some of them are going to big boy prison. And one young man that I met has the very unfortunate reality that he has been sentenced to life imprisonment. How do you reach someone like that? And so you try to teach them that every one of them has the possibility of being a successful human being. You know, his reality may have very different parameters than other people, but you can have a successful life. And so people ask me, you know, what's the Reader's Digest version of how you can have a successful life? And I've distilled it down to four things. And I'll tell you the four things quickly, but I'm going to circle back to what you just said, but we're all dealing with things. It doesn't matter whether you're a CEO or what. So, you know, the first one is, we learned it in kindergarten, the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Simple. The second one is, act with integrity and character. Do what you say, say what you mean, be accountable, be dependable, be a man or woman of your word, okay? The third one is, be compassionate. If you cultivate, and I tell people, if you can do these four things, you've got a 99.9% chance of being a successful human being. That doesn't mean you're gonna have a yellow Ferrari. It doesn't mean that you're gonna be drinking champagne on a yacht, but you will be a successful human being at the core of your being. So here's the third one: be compassionate. You never know, and I wish I said this, but I didn't. You never know what private war another person is fighting in silence. Yeah. And you know, I use this analogy. How many times have we all been in line at the grocery store or the pharmacy, and we've got our very important stuff that we have to do, and there's a little old lady in front of you fumbling in her purse, and she's got to get her glasses on, and then she's got to get her checkbook. And now, if you could be arrested for the thoughts that you're thinking in your head, you're like, you want to, you know, and you don't, man, you don't realize if she's making the decision whether she and her husband eat that night or she can get his cancer medication. You know, you don't know what private war that person is fighting. And if we all just act with a little more compassion to each other, just take a breath. You know, understand that everybody's dealing with something, and ask how you'd like to be treated. It goes back to the first one. If somebody knew, are you struggling with drugs and alcohol? Are you a survivor of childhood trauma? Is your wife leaving you? Did you just get fired? Is your wife leaving you for your boss who just fired you? You know, all sorts of shit goes on in people's lives. And if we just try and cultivate a little more compassion, this is going to be a better world. And then the fourth thing is simple. It's grind. Work harder than everybody. Get up early. Be the first person there. Leave late. You know, give 110%. Always seek to bring value to every interaction you have, whether it's at school, at business, or you're holding a door open for somebody, or you're just smiling at the checkout person whose feet hurt, who's doing a double shift to feed their kids and is in a lousy mood, and you smile at them, and that gives them a temporary connection with another human being that might make the difference of them being able to get through that one more day. Just bring value to everything. And like I said, if you can do those four things, I think you got a real good shot at being a successful human being.
And I love that. And especially, I'm a big empathy guy. That's my gift God gave me. And if somebody would have realized what Robin Williams was going through the night before he hung himself in a closet, I think things would have been a lot better. But a lot of people are just, they're not very empathetic. They're just like, hey, there's the funny man. But you don't know what somebody's really dealing with. So I wanted to say that.
You know, I know this might be a little tangential to the conversation, but there's a reason why comedians tend to be some of the greatest dramatic actors. Yep. You know, when comedians are, comedy is a funny thing. I do stand up. You know, you're interacting with the audience, and it's a very external. You're putting the energy out there, and acting's different. Acting is, you know, you're connecting authentically and emotionally, and you're not using your comedy as an artifice that creates a buffer. And so many of these great comedians have got so much pain and pathos in their lives that when they turn off the switch to use it for stand-up comedy, and they hone it down like a laser and use it authentically in acting, they're brilliant. I mean, how many brilliant dramatic roles did Robin Williams have? I mean, he was just heartbreaking in, you know, Good Will Hunting and so many. And he's just one of many comedians who are like that. And it's a great analogy for the fact that you don't know what private war somebody else is fighting.
And I'm an old guy. I'm 55, and I remember Mr. Miyagi.
Hey, brother, I'm older than you.
Yeah, but you look better than me. So, but Mr. Miyagi, you know, he was unhappy. A lot of people don't remember Mr. Miyagi on Happy Days.
Come on, Arnold. I used to listen. I used to run home from elementary school. It was probably second grade for lunch. And I would watch Happy Days all the time. And I got the opportunity not only to work with Pat Morita, which was amazing, but years later, I got the chance to present an award to Mrs. C. You know, I got up there and I said, you know, even if my mother wasn't home, which she always was, I just said this, even when my mother wasn't home and I'd run home from lunch, I knew Mrs. C would be there for me. And isn't it funny how, you know, when you're a kid, you know, TV shows and things like that, they have such a more significant gravitas for you, because especially then, because there weren't so many, you know, there weren't PlayStations, there wasn't the internet. I mean, you know, it was one of the few sources of, you know, visual entertainment that there was. And so I think we created relationships with a lot of these characters that really resonated into our adulthood.
Yeah. Now let me ask you a question, because, you know, you beat out over 2,000 people to become the bad boy. But because I want to go back to what you said was point number four, was if you work harder than anybody else and you grind, but you kind of did something a little bit extra at the end to get that part with Mr. Ralph Macchio. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, which part of that specifically are you referring to?
Yeah, I mean, how you might have got in his face a little bit just to show that you are the bad boy.
Well, you know, so I showed up at this open call. There were like 2,000 people there. I later found out that they had seen 10,000 people for that role. And somebody told me this. I didn't know this. And I don't know if it's true, but I think it might be. I think Brad Pitt actually tried out for that, because Brad and I were in acting class together years ago, and I used to audition against each other every now and again. Anyway, so John Avildsen, who directed The Karate Kid, The Karate Kid 2, and won the Oscar for Rocky, was walking up the line of all these hopefuls, and he stopped in front of me, and he said, "All right, young man, let's do an improv." And I was like, "Okay." He says, "I want you to intimidate me." And I think I said something about if he didn't give me an audition, that he was going to see me later that night in his kitchen with a butcher knife. And he said, "I believe it." And he sent me inside. And so I go inside the soundstage, and it was like a three-ring circus. There was Entertainment Tonight was there, and Access Hollywood and all this. And then they created this set, and there's Ralph Macchio. There's the Karate Kid. And this bell sounded, which, you know, basically meant lock it up, and they're gonna film my screen test. And I'd never done a screen test before. Never really done that much professional acting other than a couple bit parts. And they said intimidate him. And so I just kind of threw this downward block and key-eyed and backed him into a corner. And he was like, call him off. And then I started thinking, oh my God, did I go too far? Now does he think I'm like a full psycho? It wound up working out okay. But I will tell you this, I wasn't the first choice for the role of Mike Barnes. They hired someone else. And this goes back to what I said about, you know, mental attitude, working hard. I've been the second choice a lot of times in my career, and nobody remembers that. All they remember is how'd you play once they put you in the game. You know, they don't remember if you're the guy sitting on the bench waiting to get in the game. And so if you're willing to, you know, keep working hard and keep a good attitude and everything, I feel like the universe supports that kind of behavior and it rewards you.
Okay. So, cause like I did nothing for the last 48 hours, but it was Sean time. I'm watching The Karate Kid 3 and I'm like, I'm trying to put myself in your position. I'm like, what would it must have felt like to kick a chick? Or to throw the bonsai tree off. And if you must have thought to yourself, wow, I must really be an asshole to kick some chick and throw the bonsai tree off of that. So what was that like? You know, because you were like, wow, I'm not really an asshole, but I got to play an asshole.
It was kind of fun because I guess I got to get in touch with a part of my personality that I certainly don't draw on very often. But I guess somewhere deep down, some of that lurks inside of me. I think it lurks inside of all of us. As an actor, you know, it's my job to be able to get in touch with it. So it was a lot of fun. You know, the final scene at the All Valley Tournament, they really just kind of, quote unquote, let me off the chain and said, just go for it. And, you know, a lot of that dialogue was improvised. Some of it was dialogue that was given to me by John Avildsen to say, kind of specifically a lot of the sort of the racial stuff about towards Mr. Miyagi. That was kind of stuff John came up with. And, you know, I don't know that you'd ever be able to do that now, but it made the character that much scarier that he was willing to cross those lines and, you know, berate Daniel's teacher using these negative racial epithets and everything. It's not something that I would ever feel comfortable doing, but I think it worked for the character.
Okay, now, obviously, I got deep into your story and I read something about, you know, Boston College. Boston College actually whipped my Miami Dolphins Miami Hurricanes.
Boston University. Yeah.
So let you know, I think that you would have made the perfect guy to replace Patrick Swayze as a bouncer, because didn't you have a little of experience as a bouncer?
Did actually. So I actually was a doorman at a bar.
The stadium, right?
Across from the stadium, called Father's Two. And I'll never forget one night, the captain of the BU wrestling team, who was in the unlimited weight division, came in, and this guy got hammered and started pulling his pants down. And, you know, I'm getting paid like $6 an hour and free beer. And they said, go over and, you know, deal with him. And I'm like, are you out of your fucking mind? So I went up to him and I said, listen, if you will just keep your pants on, I will buy you beer for the rest of the evening. So that was more the line of the kind of bouncer I was than necessarily beating people up.
Okay, so now Karate Kid comes out. You were awesome in it. And I think for me, I was cheering for you the whole time. I'm always the guy. I always liked the bad boys because I was a bad boy. So I was cheering for you the whole time. I wanted you to win, by the way, just so you know.
Me too. I got you. Yeah, every time I watch it, I keep hoping the outcome is going to be different, but it isn't.
So my best friend, his name is Jason Calabrese. He's like, so what did it feel like, you getting in all the good kicks and then still losing?
Well, it is called The Karate Kid, so I had a pretty good idea how things were going to wind up, you know. But I'll tell you, it was, on so many different levels, a life-changing experience. And, you know, you got to remember something, Richard. I was a guy that bought a ticket to see The Karate Kid and bought a ticket to see The Karate Kid 2. And there I am, and I'm the guy. Do you know what I mean? And, I mean, I show up at the set for the first time where it's the All Valley Tournament, and it looks exactly like it did in the movie, except there's Mike Barnes' name up on the, you know, whatever it's called. And you know, I'm looking around, and there's hundreds of extras. And, I mean, it was surreal. And it was just such a rush. And it was to date still one of the most fun experiences I've had as an actor, because I was a fan, you know. I mean, I was a fan of the Karate. It's funny, I've had the opportunity to work in a lot of productions where I started out as a fan. I'll tell you a quick story. When I was a kid, my dad went to some event, and for some reason Chuck Norris was there, and he brought a photo home to me, and it said, hey, Sean, keep on kicking Chuck Norris. And I was like, that's crazy. You know, that was so cool, right? I was a kid. And decades later, I got to do Walker, Texas Ranger and have a fight scene with Chuck. I mean, it was just, you know, if that's not a dream come true, to be able to work with a legend like Chuck Norris, and, you know, working with Ralph Macchio and a lot of the other stuff I got to do. So I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, I am still a fan of a lot of things. And that's why it keeps my passion burning. You know, I just don't know what's coming next. And it's always something fun and exciting. And I'm always excited and happy to be a part of it.
So what, Sergeant Damon says, what did you see the karate kid with the new Karate Kid?
I did. The one with Jaden Smith?
Yeah.
No, I saw parts of it. I haven't watched the movie in its entirety.
Okay. So now let me ask you, because you got a chance to work with some great people, Pat Morita, Macchio, Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
How, what is it like even being in a room with a legend like that?
Well, I didn't actually get to be in a room with Francis Ford Coppola. I'm so sorry. I starred in the television series The Outsiders based on S.E. Hinton's book, which I
love the movie too. I loved it.
Yeah, and oddly enough, you know, Ralph Macchio was one of the stars of the movie. I was auditioning for the role of one of the greasers, and I went in a bunch of times, and they finally just said, you know, you're just too damn clean cut. And, you know, I was a young actor, so I didn't really, you know, now I could do it. Now I know how to alter my look and all that sort of stuff. But they said, they really liked me. And they said, we want you to read for the leader of the Socias, the rich kids gang. And, you know, I didn't really know if I had a chance of getting it. And I just remember there was a line my character said at the end of the audition. Well, how do you like that? And I was like, I got to come up with a way really quickly for these people to remember me. And so I just at the end pulled my pants down to my underwear. I go, well, how do you like that? And they were just like, what the hell? And I wound up getting the job. And it was a great experience. Unfortunately, it only went one season. But it was just like the book, The Outsiders. I mean, you know, the cool cars and the greasers and the socias and the clothes and all that sort of stuff. Great experience.
But now, you know, besides Karate Kid, you were in General Hospital, Young and a Restless. You were everywhere. But you were also, as we were talked about when we were with Robert Garcia, obviously introduced us. Yeah. You were struggling with some stuff. Like, and everybody knows I'm a recovering alcoholic and addict with 35 years clean.
Oh, wow, man. Congratulations.
You know, so we can go to work and people don't know the demons that we're actually battling, even if we're showing up to work. So were you struggling?
I think most people had a pretty good idea about my demons. I didn't do a great job of hiding it. Yeah, that's something I struggled with for a really long time. And, you know, I think I said this on my interview on Robert's podcast the other day. You know, success is funny. It's like an iceberg. You know, and people just tend to see the shiny piece of ice that sticks out of the water, which represents your success. And they don't see the gigantic piece of ice that goes down into the water five times deeper that not only represents your self-sacrifice and your hard work and your struggles, but it represents, you know, your shame and your pain and you know, insecurity and all that stuff. And so I had a point in my life where I legitimately didn't know if I was going to make it. And when I say make it, I don't mean hurt myself or anything like that, but I just didn't know if I was ever going to be the guy that, you know, like we say in recovery, the guy that got it. I just didn't think I could get it. Because I could stay sober for a really long time and I could be very high functioning and then I would just burn it down. And ultimately, you know, I think I did that sort of thing because I didn't think I deserved it. And so it was a form of self-sabotage. And, you know, when I hit about 50, I just started making some really significant changes in my life. I really started doing some work on myself. And what had always been a monumental struggle to stay sober, that sort of white knuckling thing you hear about, I turned it over to God. And, you know, it was something I couldn't do myself. You know, when they talk about a power greater than you that relieves you of the obsession, I couldn't do it myself. And it was done for me. And so for that reason, I live in daily gratitude and I do my absolute best to serve God and my fellow man. And it's kind of my way for, I guess, atoning for my sins and, you know, achieving some kind of absolution and paying forward the gift that I've been given.
And, you know, and I believe that Michelle is your angel. My Michelle is my angel. She has my blind side, literally, because I'm still 60% blind. So she literally has my blind side. But I can tell you the exact moment. My come to Jesus moment was when I was looking at 5 years hard time for grand larceny. Take us back to your come to Jesus moment. Take me back to the day before your come to Jesus moment and the day after. Because a lot of people have come to Jesus moments, but they don't do anything on the day after to actually get out of the problem that they were in. So take us to the day before, the day of, and the day after.
You know, my wife has always been very supportive of me. She's never said, I'm leaving you. She never used that kind of behavioral modification technique with me. But I remember one time after I'd, you know, gone on a bender and everything, and she came in the bedroom. She wasn't angry. And you always have to be aware. When a woman's not angry, that's the time you really better be paying attention, right? You know, you always say, as long as you got them talking, and even if you got them yelling, you're still in the game, right? But it's when they get silent that you need to worry. And she just said, listen, you know, I have put everything I have into this relationship. Please tell me I didn't back the wrong horse. And for some reason, that was so powerful to me. And I was like, this beautiful woman who loves me unconditionally, I am not going to take her down because of my behavior and my challenges. And it just, you know, and I also pray, you know, and I also, for a long time, I prayed every day, every morning. I get on my knees. It's the first thing I do every morning, still, every day, including today. And I would ask God, please remove this from me. And I just kept praying and I just kept praying and it happened. You know, another thing that had a profound effect on me was somebody said to me once, or I read it, I don't remember. They said, would you give up one thing to have everything? And I thought about that. And I've had everything in my life before. I have everything now. You know, I have, you know, financial comfort. I have a loving family. I have my health. I have everything. And I thought, wow, if all I have to do is give up drinking and I can have everything, that sounds like a real good deal. And, you know, for me, it had always been that, well, you know, I'm going to be boring, or life is going to be boring, or I'm going to miss it. And it goes back to that great quote by Joseph Campbell, who said, the treasure that we seek exists in the cave we fear to enter. And for so long, I was afraid to go into that cave and do battle with the dragon, the guard of the treasure, that was a wonderful, fully formed, meaningfully happy life, you know? And the dragon, of course, was my addiction. And I didn't have the power to win that fight myself. And that's why I fully give thanks to, you know, the big guy for giving me the strength and the power and the resiliency and tenacity to fight one more time. Because, you know, I think the hardest thing that people don't realize when people are struggling with an addiction issue, they think that it's a behavioral flaw. And I guess in some ways it is. I mean, I don't know that I 1,000% subscribe to the concept that it's a disease, but yeah, okay, whatever. But the point I'm trying to make is that they don't realize that most likely the people struggling have tried again and again to kick it, and they've not had success. And so what happens is it culminates and you start to think, you know, why the hell am I going to try again? Yeah, sure. Maybe I'll put it together for 2 weeks, and maybe my family will start talking to me again, and maybe I'll find a job. And you know what? I'm just going to burn the damn house down all over again. So why not save everybody the trouble and just not even do it? And you start to allow hopelessness to creep in. And hopelessness is the, and you know, it's the enemy of faith. And you have to have faith and just believe that it's going to happen and keep working towards it.
But now, because as I watched your old Studio City, the whole thing last night, I watched Karate Kid 3 last night, I watched season 5 late yesterday, so I was up for hours. And then as I'm driving, I had to go take care of my mom. She's in a rehab. Something that Jocko Willink said, and something that I heard, I don't remember if it was in the movie or the show, was that there's no bad students. It's only the bad teachers. And I believe that if you don't find the right mentors, that you can never be successful. And who you hang around with is who you're going to be. If there's 6 millionaires, 5 millionaires, and you're hanging around with them, guess who's going to be the sixth? But if you have five guys that are cheating on their wives and getting divorced, who's going to be the sixth?
Yes, sir. You are right. Yep.
So talk about mentorship.
Well, I'm a huge proponent of mentorship. Had some very powerful mentors in my life. My father being one of them. Sensei Demura being one of them. My other martial arts teacher, Sensei William Stoner. I've been very fortunate. Some teachers that I've had. And, you know, for a long time in my earlier life as an actor, when I was not behaving well, I used to always say, well, look, I'm nobody's role model. And then the funniest thing happened when I started behaving with integrity and when I started looking to do estimable acts, I saw that people were starting to look at me as a man of integrity and seek me out as a mentor. And I was kind of almost like, wait, me? You mean that guy back there, right? And I've realized that, you know what? I am a mentor for people, and I like it, and I welcome that responsibility. And that doesn't mean that I don't F up, and it doesn't mean that I don't struggle with things still. But what it means is I'm on the path. I'm self-aware. I'm at least identifying the issues that I still have to deal with and trying to deal with them. And those things that I have dealt with, I can now pass that information along to other people. You know, and it's not about pulling people up the mountain. You got to climb up the mountain yourself. But it's about pointing out some little pitfalls and rocks and holes along the path that will help people with their ascension to the top of the mountain. And, you know, most great men in history have had a mentor relationship. You know, you look at Galileo had Aristotle. Bill Gates had Warren Buffett. There's a reason why, you know, you've got retired baseball players that become pitching and batting coaches that mentor the young players. You know, they've been there, they've done it, they've got, you know, battle tested knowledge to pass on. And I think if you haven't sought out a mentor, you need to do that. And in both of my books, Way of the Cobra and Welcome to the Kumite, I talk at length about that. And I tell you how to do it. You know, you got to get clear on what it is that you want from a mentor. You've got to get clear on what it is that you can bring to the relationship. Because it's like I said, you always got to bring something to the relationship. And then you have to decide who has what you want. And I don't mean materialistically, but who is it that is achieving what you want to achieve? And then reach out to them. You know, reach out to Mark Cuban, reach out to, you know, I don't know who. All they can say is no, but my God, what if they say yes? You know, and if you can benefit from the knowledge of those people that have achieved what you want to achieve, you know, I'm a big proponent of the saying, stand on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. You know, life is hard enough. Ask for help. People, especially men, you know, we've got this huge, I don't want to ask for help. You know, let me tell you something. As an actor, my business is so difficult. I would ask for help from anyone who can give it to me because, you know, Tom Cruise isn't my dad. Okay. You know, Brad Pitt isn't my brother. It is a very, very difficult business. And you know what? Most businesses are difficult. And if you've got somebody who is willing to give you their time to open some doors for you, my God, take advantage of it. And you know what your responsibility is? Your responsibility is to pay that back to somebody else. Okay. So that way, you know, it's not being weak, taking help. It's not, you know, being a taker. You know, you're going to do it and acquire this knowledge so you can then become a mentor and you can then help somebody else. And that is the essence of the way of the Cobra. It's a never ending circle of gaining knowledge, passing it on to others so they in turn can pass it on to others. And what does it do? It's kind of like the Force in Star Wars, you know? You know, when you do good things, you do estimable acts and put out good vibrations, the Force gets stronger. And when there are acts of, you know, anger and aggression and jealousy and pettiness, it weakens the Force. I'm a firm believer in that.
Well, don't you even believe that, you know, even Dale Carnegie taught the guy that wrote Think and Grow Rich, and the word is think. It's not work and grow rich. It's actually think. And for me, like with you, when we were on the call, I actually downloaded your Audible book. I was listening to it today. And I actually ordered every book that's available. Still looking for the cooking book, but we'll talk about that. If you can't be, like, I may not be able to come out to California or to one of your events, but I can get Audible for $15 a month and get every book that you have and learn from you. Because my brain doesn't know the difference whether you're physically there or if I'm just hearing it through my eardrum. Your body doesn't know any different. So yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's funny. For me, it was imperative that I was the one who recorded my audiobook.
Yeah.
And I think even if you've read Way of the Cobra before, hearing me read it will give you a very different inference to the information because, you know, my passion and the intonation, I know exactly how I want to hit certain things to best affect the listener. And you know, look, not everybody likes to read. I love to read, but not everybody does. And you know, you can get it on Audible and listen to it while you're doing your workout or something. And I mean, you know, it's a game changer. I'm not a big fan of false modesty. A lot of the stuff that I say, you've probably heard before in some,
there's my copy right there. Yes, Way of the Cobra.
But, you know, sometimes it's the messenger who finally gets through to you. You know, it's kind of like that thing when you're 14, 15, 16 and you're fighting with your dad. It doesn't matter how good the information he's giving you. You're like, F you, dad. You know, you can't hear it. And then suddenly a guy like me comes along and basically says the same thing your dad was saying. And it's revelatory. You know, it's you have to be in a place of willingness to accept the information. And the messenger has to have a way of speaking to you. Speaking with you. And that's what I try and do in the book. I try and speak with my reader rather than speaking at them. You know, I have elevated myself to the position of being a sensei or a teacher. And I realized that if I'm going to do that, I need to share with my readers, you know, my shortcomings, my struggles, my failures, to show them that, you know, I didn't have all the answers and I still don't. But this is how I work to achieve them. And I wanted to humanize it so that it wasn't just kind of this, you know, didactic book where I was preaching at you, because nobody likes that.
But now you and your bride, Michelle with one L, are writing a new book. And I told you, I want to be the first person to buy it. I want an autographed copy.
The honor.
So talk about that, you know, writing a book, you know, with your bride. Talk about that.
So we are writing the third installment of the Way of the Cobra series, and it's called Cobra Couples. And it is formatted the same as Way of the Cobra and Welcome to the Kumite, but now I have a co-sensei, my wife, Michelle. And, you know, it's back in the dojo. The chapters are divided into belts, and it is both a male and female perspective on how to become a Cobra couple. And a Cobra couple is a fully functioning, integrated relationship where you are living your best life, you are still maintaining your individuality while still working with your partner for common goals. And, you know, I don't believe that another person completes you. I believe another person pushes you and creates the environment in which you can be your best self. Okay. And, you know, I say it in the book, the right one will make you and the wrong one will break you. And, you know, a lot of what we talk about in the book goes to dating, because dating is where you find a potential partner. And imagine if you had your head screwed on right when you're dating and you're not just out there chasing pretty girls or looking for, you know, the hottest guy. Sure, everybody wants to be with somebody that's physically attractive and turns them on and all that stuff. But you're also looking at somebody who has character, somebody that has common goals and values with you. And you know, one of the biggest myths, there's a section called Mythbusters, is that love conquers all. And love does not conquer all. You can love somebody, but if your ships aren't sailing in the same direction in a relationship, the relationship's not going to work. You know, you can't have, you know, one person who decides in the middle of the relationship they want to go to Harvard and study for 4 years and get their law degree all of a sudden, and you've got another partner out on the West Coast who decides, you know, they want to be a traveling salesman, and they love each other, but they're just going in two different directions. And that's a recipe for disaster. And so, you know, you need to have compatibility. And if you can have an eye towards that during the dating process, you're going to waste a lot less time and you're going to form a relationship that is going to feed you on multiple levels, not just on, you know, a sexual level, or not just on, you know, this is somebody who's really fun to hang out with and go out with, but on a really deep, permanent level where your souls come together. And that really is what allows you to ascend to be the very best version of yourself. I don't believe that you can be your very best self when you are in a relationship that is problematic and negative rather than supportive and empowering.
And don't you believe, as we're winding down, because I know you have to go, but, you know, people say marriage is 50-50, and that's bullshit. Sometimes it's 60-40. Last week, my PTSD was really bad, and it was 0-100. And I just crumbled into my wife's arms, and I just cried. And she held me. She's like, it's okay. I got you. And then there's some days she's struggling, and I'm like, I got you.
I can't tell you. Michelle has done the heavy lifting and carried me when I couldn't do it myself, and vice versa. And that's a relationship. You're right. It's not always 50-50. It's great when it is, but you know what? In the times maybe when I got to do a little more of the heavy lifting, I take pride in the fact that I'm in a place in my life as a man where I can show up and do that, because that wasn't always the case. And you know, she is fully capable of taking care of me when I need to be taken care of. And that's what a relationship is.
So now tell us what you got going on, because I know you're doing some weight loss stuff, you're doing some coaching stuff, and I'm sure when the book comes out, I'm sure you're gonna be doing some couple stuff. So what's going on in your life now?
We're gonna come back and do your show together. So next week, real busy week filming Bold and the Beautiful. I'm doing, I think I'm doing 9 shows. Crazy. Because I was out of town filming something else in Atlanta for a while. And what else is going on? March 9th and 10th, I'm going to be offering 4 seminars. I'm going to be offering my Unleash seminar, which is all the information on Way of the Cobra, personal development, getting out of your own way, setting your goals, achieving them. That is going to be, I believe, from 10 to 12 a.m. on, I believe it's on the 10th. And then my Way the Cobra Blueprint for Weight Loss is going to be from 1 to 3 Pacific time. Look, I've lost 50 pounds. I know what I'm talking about. If you're struggling with your weight and you want to lose it, I can help you. And then I have my acting seminars on Sunday, I believe, which is acting in the business of acting, and then the crushing the monologue, where you'll actually get to do a monologue. All of this information is up on Twitter, and it's up on my Instagram, which is Sean.Kanan. And if you're interested and you would like, they're only $49 each. I make them affordable so that everybody can do them. And they're taught live by me on Zoom. You can email me at sean.canan@gmail.com and I'll get you in the seminar. And I'll tell you what, if you don't love it, I'll give you your money back. And nobody's ever asked yet.
I love it. Your IG is fire, by the way. I just want to say that. I shared a couple of your things onto my IG. So I just wanted to say, I love it
so much. I really appreciate it.
Brother, I'm so grateful and humble for you and your bride. So I just want to say thank you. I want to thank Robert Garcia, the Warrior Strategy. He put this together, and without him, the Warrior Council, I would not be able to hang out with you and hopefully build a generational relationship with you.
And I just, you know, I just want to say to all the veterans from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for all that you've done for us, for all that you give and continue to give, and for your families, because we all know that, you know, it's not just the person that's in active service, it's the family too that's in active service. And I want to thank all of them. I'm a huge supporter of our military and our law enforcement. And I just want to say God bless all of you and thank you so much.
I love you, brother. Thank you so much.
We'll have an amazing day. Okay.
Be good.
Thank you for joining us today. Please hit subscribe and share. Please feel free to leave us a comment.